Hi, my name is Brooke Taylor, one of the leaders of Missio Church. We exist to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ without having to come or go anywhere. Thank you so much for listening to our sermon series through the Old Testament book of Esther, The Faithfulness of the Forgotten God. We are so excited about what God is teaching us about himself and ourselves through his word, and about the transformation that he's doing in us, making us more into the image of Jesus Christ. It is the prayer of Missio Church that this sermon might encourage you and strengthen you in your faith and walk with Jesus. It is the desire of the elders of Missio Church that this sermon would not serve as a replacement for you gathering with the local church and submitting to the leaders that God has put over your life. If we can help you in any way, please reach out to us at www.missiochurch.faith or by calling us at 631-924-4943 anytime. You can also visit us on any Sunday at 10 a.m. at 70 Smith Road in Ridge, New York, on the eastern end of Long Island. We hope you enjoy today's message through the Old Testament book of Esther. Long before the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills or Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Robin Leach hosted Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, a TV series highlighting the extravagant living of wealthy athletes and entertainers and socialites beginning in 1984. Leach would end each episode with a signature catchphrase, maybe some of you know it, champagne wishes and caviar dreams. And the show allowed us, regular people, to get a chance to see the elaborate lifestyles of celebrities of that day, like Princess Diana or Michael Jackson, Pierce Brosnan, Clint Eastwood, even the Pope. We would see yachts and planes and indoor swimming pools, any amenity that you could dream of or consider in your own mind would be on that TV show. And it was a show that would demonstrate these lavish lifestyles of what we might be able to have if we had endless amounts of resources, if we were the richest person on earth. After Leach died, the show kind of just drifted into the history books, but our current culture has released new shows like House Hunters and My Lottery, Dream Home, or Million Dollar Listing to lure us to lust for a lavish, over-the-top lifestyle that might meet all of our desires, wealth, and power. That is what the world lives for, and that is what we are tempted to live for as well. If the lavish excess of our culture is immense, the situation in Susa is so over the top that it makes lifestyles of the rich and famous look like the Beverly Hillbillies before they found black gold. Whether we live in 483 BC or 2026, the same temptations arise to crave for riches, to grasp for power, to lust for beauty. But in the end, whether we are Xerxes or Robin Leach or Jeff Bezos, worldly riches and power are fleeting. They will not last. At least, not if we seek to find them apart from the Creator who gives beauty and riches and glory that never fade away. And so this morning we want to consider the theme, worldly pleasures and the faithfulness of God. Worldly pleasures and the faithfulness of God. I want you to notice first in verse 1, the commanding presence of power in the kingdoms of this world. It says in verse 1, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 120 provinces, Esther begins attracting our eyes and instilling fear in our hearts. Ancient Persia is in the same area that we know of as modern-day Iran. And it was about the size of Alaska, but at its peak In the prime of Esther's time, Persia spanned three continents. The Nile River in Egypt, leading all the way to the mountains of Asia, and the Mediterranean Sea all the way to the gates of India. It occupied Israel and up the coast to the edges of Greece. And verse 1 says the king reigned over 127 provinces. Now, the typical description of the empire's regions was satraps. And we know there were about 20 of those. Daniel 6:1 also talks about satraps. He says there's 120. But I think Daniel, most likely, and Esther are saying the same thing. They're not talking about satraps. They're talking about provinces or regions. And the point that Esther and Daniel are making is that Persia is massive, that the kingdom stretched in every direction, that Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as it says in our Bible, is the ruler of the known world at that time. His kingdom is powerful. His name alone is mentioned 175 times in the book of Esther. The author wants us to know that he is the big cheese, as my son's book says, and you better believe it, because he is in charge and he commands respect and attention and honor, all while simultaneously God's name is not mentioned one single time. The king rules the world, and everyone is to kneel in fear at his strength. The might of his nation is unstoppable. He's defeating everyone who comes along his way. Now, there is no outward hostility towards the Jewish people at this point in the book of Esther. That will become a focus later on. But the implication that the author is setting up for us now is that while there is no hostility yet, when hostility arises for God's people, there is no place for them to hide. Xerxes rules the world. His empire is unavoidable. His power is unstoppable. And if we are not impressed by his power, we are not paying attention. His presence commands attention. But secondly, in verses 2-9, we see the captivating presence of prosperity in the kingdoms of this world. It says in verse 2 that in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him. And while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his pomp and his greatness for many days, 180 days. So, Xerxes' name means ruler over men. He is 32 years old when he becomes king. And right now, Esther chapter 1 is the third year of his reign. So he's about 35 in 483 BC. And he's sitting on a throne in Susa. Now, Susa is not the capital of the kingdom. There were four citadels or capitals throughout the empire that the king ruled from. Susa was not a comfortable place to be in the summer because it was very, very hot. But in the winter, it was an ideal place for the king to rule for about 4 months. Susa was built by his father, Darius. And if you remember, in Daniel had a vision from Susa in chapter 8, verses 2. Nehemiah served in Susa as a cupbearer to Xerxes' son. And so here you have this king sitting on the throne, and he invites all of the kingdom officers and servants and military commanders and leaders from across his empire for a feast. Now, parties in our culture, right, whether it's a wedding reception or a birthday party, or even just a 4th of July bash, they often bring out the worst in people. I can remember being at a wedding reception where a lot of the guests, including groomsmen, were standing on tables drunk out of their minds, laughing and dancing and singing. We often read about people who let their hair down at parties, and disaster often occurs. Sometimes even people die. Well, this party that the king plans and hosts, the parties in Persia were known and famous for their lavish food and the immense amount of alcohol. This particular party lasted 180 days. Now, if you're not a math person, that's about 6 months of partying. Now, this is not a dinner party. This is not an 8-year-old's birthday at Chuck E. Cheese. This was a rager. This was like a frat party that had been pumped up on steroids. This is a wild, drunken affair. And we can only imagine the kind of wretched sinfulness that would go on at a party like this. What comes to my mind immediately is what we've heard described that went on Jeffrey Epstein's island. And so for 6 months, this king has this feast, and in doing so, he's flaunting his wealth and his prosperity and his splendor. But why does he do it? Why does he have a party for 6 months for all of these people? Well, likely it's to impress all of his military supporters. He needs investors to buy into what he is selling. Now, historically, this feast coincides with a war council that King Xerxes has in 483 BC. A few years earlier to this, his father was defeated and killed attempting to take Greece. Xerxes plans to invade Greece again, partly because he is not satisfied with the 20 satraps and the 127 regions that he already has. He wants more power. But he also wants to do it for revenge. He wants to conquer the people that killed his father. In fact, some of the historical records from Persia quote the king as saying this: "For this cause I have summoned you together that I may impart to you my purpose. It is my intent to lead my army through Europe to Greece that I may punish the Athenians for what they have done to the Persians and to my father. You saw that Darius, my father, was minded to make an expedition against these men, but he is dead and it was not granted him to punish them. And I, on his and all the Persians' behalf, will never rest till I have taken and burnt Athens to the ground." So the king has this party, this 6-month party, during this great time of peace to prepare themselves for an attack. Xerxes has this peace. He can afford to have a party like this because there is no threat to him. Egypt has been defeated. He has crushed all the opposition. No attack is imminent. The Greeks are not going to invade. He has no fears, and so his mantra is, don't worry, be happy, just party for 6 months. And in doing so, he takes time to impress all of his leaders with the pomp and wealth and power of his empire. He is flaunting the prosperity under his rule. He is showing everyone who is in charge of the empire and to drum up support for his military campaign. He's gaining loyalty face to face with all of his advisors. And like any good king or politician would do, he makes promises to his friends and his business partners and his cronies that if you support me in this war, I will reward you when we win. Now, some suggest that there were more than 15,000 people at this party. Now, the kings of Persia were particularly known in the ancient world for generously rewarding those who were loyal to the kingdom. And so Xerxes lays out all of his prosperity as if to say to all of those leaders, trust me, if you support me and invest in me, your reward will be great. Because my army cannot be stopped, my enemies cannot contain us, and the wealth of Persia will grow, and the spoils of war will be shared with all of you. Now, the king of Assyria, Ahasuerus II, he also held a banquet for more than 69,000 men and women, including 5,000 international dignitaries, to do the same kind of thing. These kinds of feasts were common. And notice when the feast is over, the king in verse 5 gave for all the people present in Susa, in other words, not the dignitaries, the citizens, for all of them, both great and small, he gave a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So the king throws another party. After 6 months, another party, this time for 7 days. It's a week of drinking and gluttony just for the men of Susa, the commoners, to show his gratitude for hosting all of his guests for all those months, for serving the dignitaries, for flattering the officials. This is a lavish reward for the city. You can see why the kings of Persia are known for being generously rewarding to those who back him. And the servants were to do anything that the citizens of the kingdom asked for. So use your imagination. If you want it, someone's going to get it for you. You want grapes from some faraway land, they will run and go get it. You want a cow from the best, you know, cow fields for beef, they'll go find you beef. Queen Vashti also hosts a separate feast just for all the women. Many cultures do this. They separate the feasts of the men and the women. And we don't know if the women's feast was a more dignified affair than the men's feast. But these were lavish, drinking, drunken affairs for the people of the city. Now, the palace in Susa itself was a sight to behold. And the feast itself, says, this 7-day feast, takes place in the garden of the king's palace. Persia was known for beautiful gardens. And of course, kings and gardens are intricately connected in the Bible and in history. Both before and after the events in the book of Esther, the Persian kings developed royal paradise gardens. Cyrus built a palace complex that you see pictured here in Persia, adorned with gardens and canals, bridges and pools and pathways. One of the gardens measured 150 meters by 120 meters. So if you don't follow swimming or track and field, it's about 170 yards long and 150 yards wide. That's almost 50% larger than a football field. Darius began construction of what the current palace looked like. It was his favorite place to dwell. And Xerxes completed it. However, it was destroyed by fire during the reign of his son. And then it was restored by his grandson. The palace proper is 775 feet by 775 feet square, twice the size of a football field. You can see a modern picture of where they excavated the land. You can see, and then there's a second picture that if you overlay what the original dimensions were, it fits exactly to this spot that the French have excavated. There, we know more about the palace than virtually any other place in the Old Testament. And you can see the accuracy of the biblical description. This is massive. And it was more beautiful than it was described. Susa, the word Susa, is derived from the Hebrew word Shushan, meaning lily or rose, a six-leaved white flower. And Susa was as beautiful as a flower. The English word paradise comes from the Persian word paraditsa. And the description in Esther of this Persian garden and the furniture and other elements in it is astounding. As it was being read by Marlene, you could close your eyes and imagine what is being described. Beautiful cotton, white linens, violet drapes, silver curtain rods, marble pillars. Even the sofa is made of gold. I don't know how comfortable that was to sit on, but that would have been beautiful to look at. The dishes are gold. I have china dishes, right, with like a strip of gold on them. These were made of solid gold. The cups are gold. The roads are probably gold. And there's precious stones and pearls in them. I mean, this is beyond extravagant. It's beautiful and glorious and captivating. And the description of the garden and the palace is intended, just like the size is intended to make you fear, the picture of this garden is intended to stun you, to take your breath away, to leave no doubt who has all the wealth in the world. It is King Xerxes. Persia's wealth even dazzled the great Alexander the Great from Greece. When he entered Susa's palace a century after this, 100 years later, he found 40,000 talents of gold and silver bullion. He found 9,000 talents of minted gold coins. The coins alone would be 330% of the kingdom's annual tax revenue. The king has endless wealth and power and authority. He controls everything. Even drinking, according to verse 8, was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. In other words, Xerxes is not saying, if you are not a drinker, don't drink. What he is saying is that no one will stop you from drinking ever. There is no last call. You can drink till you throw up, and then you can get up and you can do it again. And so the six-month party is a drunken mess. This week-long party is a drunken mess. And they're to party like there is no tomorrow. I mean, Xerxes is really unlike anything else in history. And he loves his wealth, and he loves his power, and he flaunts his wealth, and he flaunts his power. He has confidence in his wealth, and he has confidence in his power. And we are meant to see this and marvel at his wealth and prosperity and power and authority and prestige. All this extravagance is meant to show who the God of Persia is. The king who sits on a throne on top of an Acropolis, which is described as being 120 feet in the air. Exalting himself higher than all the mortals around him and all the idols that he worships, declaring with every word and every move, I am God, worship me. I mean, Xerxes was made for reality TV. And the things that Persia loves are the very things that we love. Wealth, power, comfort, control. Our culture tries to draw us in to find joy and contentment in the same things, to find security in the same things, to be impressed and to worship the same things. Because the world says, if you have all this, your life will be good and you will be happy. So give up everything. Exchange everything. Sell your soul to get this. Xerxes has all the wealth and riches and power, and if you want it, you must come through him to get it. We are to be captivated by the presence of prosperity in the kingdoms of this world. But we also need to be warned that there is a capricious presence of prosperity and power in the kingdoms of this world. Chapter 1 tells us very little about the plot of Esther. It's almost like it doesn't even go together. It names one player that we see throughout the rest of the story, and that's King Ahasuerus. It tells us when and where, Persia, 483 BC. And we are impressed by it, and it's designed to make us envy and fear. And yet, there is irony to the splendor and excess and pomp and lavish lifestyle the king flaunts to gain support to go to war. The Jews reading Esther in 200 BC know the end of the story before they read it. And the author could have led with where things are currently for Persia. But it doesn't. Instead, it begins with all the optimism and beauty and confidence, wanting us to see how great this is, and then wanting us to then see the great reversal that takes place. You see, the wealth and the reach and the authority and power of Persia, it is all temporary. Xerxes will go to war with Greece in between chapters 1 and chapters 2. There's a pause of time. He will go to war. And he will take nearly 1 million soldiers to face Greece. And Greece and King Leonidas will come with 300 Spartans. Just 300. Perhaps you've seen the movie 300 that dramatizes this. And Greece will defeat Persia with 300 soldiers. The promise of wealth for his supporters will be broken. His avenging of his father's death will fail. And the Greeks, when the Persians were retreating, they left a tent behind on the battlefield, and the Greeks were astounded when they looked into that tent, and what did they see? Gold and silver couches. And it all meant nothing. Because Xerxes returns to Persia broke, defeated, and humiliated. And not only that, but 18 years after that, 18 years later, Xerxes will be assassinated by a member of his inner circle. He will die at about 50 years old. And then 100 years after that, the Greeks and Alexander the Great will conquer Persia and crush it into oblivion. The problem with the things that this kingdom of the world prioritizes and loves and pursues and takes from others and protects and hoards is that it is all temporary. They're all fleeting. Not one of those golden couches will last. God's people must see through the capricious nature of all of this, to see the world and all that it values from a new perspective. Not to be dazzled by the beauty and wealth and empty promises or enamored by its prestige and power, because it's all laughable. We are meant to laugh at Xerxes because he does this 6-month feast and celebration, and in the end, he wasted every penny he spent. We're meant to laugh at the world that prioritizes things it can't take with them. And we're meant to laugh at ourselves because oftentimes we are just like Xerxes, only we don't have what we want. The king's pursuit of so many empty, worthless things is ridiculous. And yet, how ridiculous is it that we seek a fraction of what he had? Because when the curtain is pulled back and Xerxes is exposed, he is an emperor that flaunts his wealth and power and authority and reach, but in reality, he has no clothes. And if we put stock in the things of this world, we will not just lose our stuff either. We will lose, the Bible says, our souls. The king who seems to have absolute power, immense riches, and an unending kingdom rules for 25 years and then he is dead. Every empire throughout history has given into these priorities. Even our own country gives into these priorities, right? We've been told for the last 4 years that we are in the golden age of America. And here's the thing, it is all temporary. And the book of Esther unmasks it for us. The kingdom will promise us the world, but in the end, the return will be disappointing. So we are to value something different. But there's one last thing I want you to see, and that is the comforting presence of God's powerful and prosperous and permanent kingdom. Xerxes, as we'll see, is an arrogant, murderous, hedonistic moron. And his kingdom is temporary, and his reign is short, and his promises are found to be fleeting. And so we're encouraged to look for something more eternal. As evil as Xerxes is, the words of Esther suggest something more significant is at play here. Esther 1 begins with the same word, it was, that Genesis 1, 3, and 5, and 7, 8, 9, 11, and 13 all begin with. You see, Xerxes is a type of the true King of Kings. Xerxes' reign stretches across the known world, and it typologically points to God, the King of Heaven, whose reign stretches across the known universe. In the parables of Jesus, kings and masters almost always point to God the Father. And I think Xerxes, in all of his foolishness, his reign is meant to remind us of God. The 180-day feast, this seemingly unending banquet during a time of enduring peace with all the nobles and princes, I think is meant to remind us of heaven, an eternity of peace and life and wealth and prosperity where God rules and reigns in perfect peace with all of his angelic hosts. Job 38, verse 4 says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" As great as Xerxes is, God is greater. And then the 7-day feast of Xerxes with only one unbreakable law reminds me of the creation account. 7 days to eat whatever you want, and there's only one law. Don't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the Persian palace is meant to remind us of the paradise in Eden. Do you know that the description of Persia, this palace in Persia, is in the Bible only matched by a similar description of 3 different passages? The first is in the Garden of Eden, in Genesis chapter 2. It says, a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and there it divided. It became four rivers, and the name of the first is the Pishon, and it is the one that flowed around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good, and bdellium and onyx stone are there. The description of the palace in Persia images the Garden of Eden. And then in 2 Chronicles 3, we also see that it reminds us of the temple. The vestibule in front of the nave of the house was 20 cubits long, equal to the width of the house, and its height was 120 cubits. He overlaid it on the inside with pure gold. The nave he lined with cypress and covered it with fine gold and made palms and chains on it. And he adorned the house with settings of precious stones, and the gold was gold of Pervaim. And so he lined the house with gold, its beams, its thresholds, its walls, its doors, and he carved cherubim on it. And the third place that we see this kind of description is in the new heavens and new earth in Revelation 21. The one who spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and walls, and the city lies four square, its length the same as its width. He measured the city with his rod 12,000 stadia. Its length and width and height are equal. He also measured its walls 144 cubits by human measurement, which is also an angel's measurement. The wall was built of jasper, while the city was pure gold, like clear glass. The foundation of the wall of the city were adorned with every kind of jewel. The first was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth carnelian, and the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst, and the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each of the gates made of a single pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold like transparent glass. You see, just as Xerxes displays his glory in a palace that mirrors the Jewish temple, God displays the riches of his glory in creation, in a garden that was the prototype of the garden to come. The majesty and power and authority and riches of Xerxes points us to the majesty and power and authority and riches beyond all splendor that God has. Xerxes makes promises to reward his citizens, but fails. But God blesses and rewards those who earnestly seek him in ways unsurpassed in this world. Xerxes' kingdom lasts a little more than 200 to 300 years. God's kingdom and reign will last forever. And his inheritance and riches will never disappoint, never return void, never fade away. And they are kept in heaven, guarded for us, and secured by an everlasting covenant that he will never break in Jesus Christ, his one and only Son. It might look like the kingdoms of this world will continue to win, that they cannot be stopped, and that our choices are either to assimilate, imitate, or give in. But God has determined this world will become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. Like in Esther, even when God seems absent, he is working. Even when God seems inattentive, he is watching. Even when God seems elusive, he is there. So don't exchange his powerful, prosperous, and permanent kingdom for something that's temporary and fleeting and unrewarding. God has promised that nothing we give up in this world will ever be forgotten in the world to come. Nothing we lose in this world will not be restored in the world to come. Nothing taken from us in this world will not be given back to us tenfold, 50-fold, and 100-fold in the world to come. So prioritize something eternal. True prosperity, true wealth, true wisdom, and it is only found in being loyal to and fearing the King of Kings. True power and authority does not come from commands and edicts and manipulation. True authority and power is seen through service and love of people. Xerxes doesn't reign supreme. His empire lies in ruins today. He could not stop God's plan. The kings and rulers of our time do not reign supreme either. They cannot stop God's plan. Neither can the Greek gods or Roman gods or Muslim gods. Neither can the Nazis or Russians or even the Americans. God's plan is to bring the culmination of history under the lordship of Jesus. And Psalm 2 says, the kings of the earth will plot and scheme, but God laughs. His anointed will reign, and if anyone opposes him, they oppose God. And Esther reminds us the reversal is coming. Prosperity and power of the nations will ultimately end in destruction, and only Jesus will reign, and he will reign forever and ever and ever. So, Christian, don't look to wealth and power and influence and affluence to give you peace, contentment, protection, joy, or salvation. Those things will make grand promises, but they cannot protect you. They cannot protect your family. They cannot save you. They cannot save your family. Turn away from putting your hope in the things of this world and put your hope in Jesus, crucified for you, taking the death that you should have died to give you gifts that you don't deserve. Put your hope and trust in him. Only he can satisfy you. And Christian, do not give into the temptation to assimilate into the culture. Don't crave the caviar dreams of the kingdoms of this world. Don't lust for the power and wealth and prosperity that it can offer. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve God in money. You cannot serve God in politics. You cannot serve God in power. Don't give up the hope that you have in Jesus for temporary joys. The world's treasures are fleeting. Trust Jesus. Obey Jesus. Follow Jesus. Even if it costs your life, he will raise you from the dead. Christian, do not fear the rulers, kings, and dictators of this world. God is sovereign over all. He raised up Cyrus and he tore down Cyrus. He raised up Xerxes and he tears down Xerxes. If you want to be on the winning side of history, don't look for an earthly champion. Because you won't find security in any of them. Don't look for security in your president or Supreme Court justices or in the defeat of the Ayatollah. Look to the suffering servant, the promised Son of Man, Emmanuel, God with us. Look to Jesus. Only he will stand victorious. Are you standing with him? And Christian, rest in God's sovereignty and providence. Nothing is outside God's control. Xerxes thought he had all the power and control as he partied for 6 months. Caesar looked like he had all the power and control when he ordered a census. Presidents and prime ministers look like they have all the power and control as they declare war and drop bombs or arrest Christians. But only one has control. And he does not rule three continents. He rules the universe. And there is no place that you can go to escape him. If you make your bed in the depths, if you go to the heavens, he is there. And if you look close enough, you will see his hand guiding your every step. You know, Esther's story is sandwiched between two banquets. One for the people of this world, and one for the people of God at the end of the story. But in a way, the story of Esther does not really begin with Esther or Mordecai. It doesn't begin with a Persian king who did not know God or worship God. It begins in Genesis 1 with a God in a garden and Adam and Eve invited to a divine feast of epic proportions during a time of enduring peace that they could eat of any tree in the garden except one. And the biblical storyline, just like Esther, ends in a garden with all of God's people sitting at a new and better feast without any prohibitions. You see, Esther mirrors the story of the whole Bible from Genesis to Revelation. One man eating in a garden and then all of God's people eating in a new and better garden. Esther is about great reversal because the Bible is about a great reversal. Esther is about God's people delivered from certain death by a woman, and the Bible is about God's people delivered from ultimate death by the seed of the woman. Esther is about a mighty kingdom turned to ashes, and the Bible is about the resurrection of a new kingdom out of the ashes. Esther's story is designed to remind us as God's people living in a pagan kingdom that doesn't share our faith and our priorities, a society that judges everything by appearances, a culture that seduces us into seeking satisfaction in the temporary pleasures, and a world filled with danger all around us. And we don't have to give in to it. Esther can help us move from the counterfeit to the real, the empty to the fullness, the fading joy of worldliness to the certain joy of the kingdom of God. So don't give in. Don't give up. Don't assimilate into it. Don't imitate it. God is working out all things for our good in Jesus Christ. We don't need caviar dreams or champagne wishes. We have the promises of God secure in the death and resurrection of Jesus. No king, dictator, or president, or terrorist, or enemy can stop it. Not even the unfaithfulness of God's people can thwart it. That is the commanding presence and captivating presence and comforting presence of God's promises to us in the gospel. And they're good news.